From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, wizards, aliens, and starships. By the way, special hello to Joe and Ruth in Cleveland, Ohio, listening to us on WTAM 1100 on the AM dial, avid coast-to-coast listeners. Joe, of course, was in World War II. He's approaching 90 years of age. Thank you both for being so faithful to us. Well, arriving a little later than expected, at least three coronal mass ejections are still on the way to planet Earth, according to NOAA forecasters, expecting glancing blows to commence on April 2nd, right about now, with a 60% chance of polar geomagnetic storms when those impacts begin. They are not, I'll repeat, they are not X flares. And as we reported yesterday, a major earthquake of magnitude 8.2 struck off the coast of northern Chile, causing five deaths and triggering a tsunami that pounded the shore with two-meter-tall waves. Geologist Jim Birkeland with us. Jim, I've got to ask you, is this like something that's circling the Los Angeles area? Because we're getting a lot of big quakes all over the place.
Well, certainly in the Ring of Fire here, Pacific Coast, clear over to Asia. But did you hear about the 7.8 aftershock this afternoon?
Yeah, the aftershock is bigger than most earthquakes.
That's correct. And we had not had a 7 since November 25th, I believe. And I've been waiting for a major quake, and in my monthly predictions during each 8-day window includes a major quake, probably around the Ring of Fire. So this one was a direct hit.
And, Jim, we had a story yesterday, by the way, of bison starting to flee Yellowstone. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, if that turns out to be accurate, I would say I would be concerned. But we get a lot of misinformation and is treated as gospel, you know. We heard that there was a 100-foot rise in the floor of Yellowstone Lake here about 3-4 years ago, and I was hearing, well, that might be true, but they were going to investigate it in about 6 months during the summertime or something. Give me a break. If that were true, you'd better investigate it right now. So we do know that animals do respond to upcoming quakes, just as they respond to past 4th of July noise and thunderstorms. But if you see a sudden outpouring of animals and whales beachings and homing pigeons getting lost and all of that, then you suspect there may be something upcoming if you haven't had just Year's Eve or 4th of July.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, Jim. What do you expect for Los Angeles sometime this year?
Well, I'm getting more and more concerned because it's been quite a while since you've had a pretty big one there, and I can say that July and August are going to have huge tidal effects from the full moon and the close approach of the moon, just minutes away.
All right.
And
well,
so there's two windows
the
going from the 10th to the 17th of August, and I'm looking at July 12th to 19th. And I would suggest any of your listeners ought to send me a self-addressed envelope, and I'll send them a copy of my latest newsletter, which has been going now for 25 years every month.
All right, let me give out your website, Jim. It's SYZYGYJOB.com, and that'll be linked up for you at our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Malaysian police have ruled out involvement of any passengers and the disappearance of a missing jetliner. I have no idea how they can do that. While Australian officials warn that bad weather and a lack of reliable information impeding efforts to find wreckage from the plane, up to 10 planes and 9 ships now in a half a dozen countries, scouring a stretch of the Indian Ocean roughly the size of Britain, where the airline flight MH370 is believed, I'll put that in quotes, to have crashed more than 3 weeks ago. James Sanders, who's been with us since this episode, the downing of TWA Flight 800. Jim, I've got to ask you, almost every time you're on, the story changes or something else, and they still can't find it. I am not going to change my views that this plane is someplace else.
Well, no, they've not given you or me or anybody else, for that matter, a reason to change. The one thing they do say now that I think is putting them a step towards getting towards a fact is that it was a criminal act. But if it was a criminal act, that means there was a plan. And the one plan we know they didn't have was to go south and see if they couldn't hit an iceberg. Yeah.
Well, that's true, too. Now, in terms of the search, I mean, is it futile? Should they just stop doing what they're doing, or should they keep it?
Well, for public relations purposes, otherwise, I think they're down to less than a 1% chance of anything. It's highly improbable, but nothing's absolutely impossible. We could have had the world's dumbest hijacker out there, but that's highly unlikely. If you have to go with the percentages, it was a well-funded, it has to be well-funded in order to get the kind of expertise to put a plane down on land anywhere in this world where it, to this point, hasn't been found. If it had been found and neutralized, I'm positive we would have seen debris out there. Not because that's where it was, but, you know, in order to sell the story.
All right. Well, Jim, stay with us. That's all I can say, and let's see what unfolds in the future. Amazon has launched an internet-connected TV set-top box, as advised with Apple and Google to gain share of the lucrative television market, dubbed the Amazon Fire TV. This device is a small black box similar to Apple TV. It will cost $99. It's available right now in the United States. It will allow you to stream content from Amazon's library as well as other video on-demand services directly to your television. And this device can also be used for gaming. So technology just continues to change. The origin and history of modern lions have been revisited by scientists. A genetic analysis of living lions in museum specimens confirms that modern lions' most recent common ancestor lived around 124,000 years ago. Now, they talk about the brain in music. That's called the so-called Mozart effect. And just what does this all do to our brains? In a moment, we'll be checking in with Neil Slade on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Neil Slade, of course, teaches people how to easily release their brain's pre-existing neural circuits for high increases in creativity, intelligence, as well as numerous paranormal abilities. His website is a staple of the Internet, remains one of the most popular online resources, called neilslade.com. And we're going to talk about the brain and music. Neil, this has been going on for ages, hasn't it?
Music has been going on for ages. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you look to see when music, as we know it, first appeared in human beings, it was about 35 to 40,000 years ago. So music, you know, as melody, has been around for an awful long time. And we know this from finding musical instruments that date back to the Ice Age, such as flutes made out of the bones of birds and out of mammoth bones. So we have physical evidence that humans have been playing music for an awfully long time.
Neil, tell us a little bit of your interest on how you got to tapped into, of course, you've always studied the brain, but how about the music end of it with the brain?
Well, I actually began my musical life at about age 6 when my mother bought a piano, a used piano for $50, and brought it into the house. And I used to plunk and plink on it. And my first love was really music. And I went to college and got my degree in music and in composition and performance. And I was a professional musician beginning many years before I was interested in brain. And I actually learned about, it was brought into the field of brain and behavior research because I wanted to become a better musician. And there was a fellow that I've spoken of many times on Coast to Coast named T.D. Lingo, who's also a musician, but he ran a brain and behavior research lab. So as a musician or a budding professional musician at the age of about 28 or 29, I met him and I asked him, how can I become a better musician? And I started hanging out with him at his brain lab. And that led to my career in brain behavior and writing books about brain. But before brain, I was a musician, and had been trained, you know, growing up and then at the university as well.
Neil, what part of the brain processes this kind of music?
Well, let's ask the question first, you know, what part of the brain processes sound? You know, music first starts externally. So we, you know, sound comes into our auditory canal, into our ear canal, and it vibrates muscles, or not muscles, but bones inside, very tiny bones inside what's called the inner ear. And those bones, in turn, are connected to the eardrum, with the tympanic membrane. And it's a very small, very thin membrane that then vibrates in sync with the sound outside. And what that sound, that what that does, the eardrum is connected to another structure that looks like a snail. It's called the cochlea, and it's what we also call the inner ear. And inside this very tiny kind of snail shell structure are very small microscopic hairs. And each one is tuned to a specific frequency, as it turns out. Now, when those hairs vibrate from the sound pressure waves, that causes an electrical signal that first goes to our brain stem, and from the brain stem it then travels to the temporal lobes, which are the lobes on the side of our brain. And from the temporal lobes, then the sound moves throughout the brain in various regions depending on how we're perceiving that sound. So if the sound has certain qualities, we'll call it music. And these are defined culturally. If it doesn't have certain qualities or elements to it, we just call it sound or noise. And so that's how the sound and music gets into our brain. What we've learned in recent years, we used to think music might have been very localized in certain regions of the brain, but we found that music is one, if not the most complex type of processing that the brain does. And a lot of structures within the brain, the frontal lobes and the temporal lobes and the parietal lobes, and it's even connected to sight, as it turns out. So a lot of the brain is involved in very complex ways in processing music. And now, brain imaging is just allowing us kind of to actually see, you know, how that's going on these days.
Neil, the Mozart effect, and we played a little bit of that music leading into you. What is that?
Well, this was kind of a fad that started many years ago. And people probably recall it to some degree. And the idea was this, that if you played classical music while a woman was pregnant, and then for small children, that would automatically increase their IQ and make them much smarter. And that wasn't quite what was going on. As it turns out, it was kind of one of these urban myths in a way that grew and grew and greatly out of proportion. Now, it's not to say that listening to music doesn't enhance learning in children or other abilities. It's very true that music does that, but it's not so simple as if you just listen to Mozart, your IQ is going to go up 20 points or something.
Not a slam dunk, is it?
No. No.
Darn.
Yeah, but, you know, there have been a lot of studies. There's a fellow named Gottfried Schlage, who's a German neuroscientist, and he really wanted to get to the core of what music would do for children and if it would actually improve other skills. So he studied children, and there have been a great many studies that have, you know, corroborated his finding, but he studied specifically 10-year-old children, and he wanted to find out that if they learned a musical instrument, if that ability and those skills would carry over into other things. And that's indeed what did happen and what's been corroborated by so many people. So kids who learned how to play the violin spontaneously also had a great improvement in visual spatial skills, in math, in verbal and vocabulary skills. There was another German study that studied a boys choir in Leipzig, Germany,
and they found that they had a marked improvement in language and in syntax. So as it turns out, learning to play a musical instrument will have a great many beneficial things that will carry over into other kinds of things. And it's something that I, as a music teacher for for 30 years, actually, I've taught music for 30 years. I've seen, kids who learn music, they just tend to excel overall in a great variety of different things.
You've talked a lot on this program with me, Neil, over the years about the amygdala and its involvement in the brain and how it gives you that ability to turn things on and turn things off. Does that have anything to do with the music and the brain?
Yeah, absolutely. I could talk at great length about how the amygdala is involved. Now, if people aren't familiar with the amygdala and they haven't been listening to your show, number one, let me very briefly tell people what the function of the amygdala is. The amygdala is in our midbrain, and it's responsible for it's kind of a fulcrum in processing emotions. It helps to associate emotions with external stimulus. So, for example, if you see a snake in a path, your amygdala will click in and cause you to automatically click into fight or flight response, because your amygdala will register that that's a threat. In other words, your eye sees a snake, so the amygdala instantaneously clicks into, raising your heart rate and your blood flow and your ability to fight or flight. It also, the amygdala also automatically retrieves positive emotions. So that if you see something that stimulates you in a certain way, that your brain can your amygdala will interpret that as being beneficial to your survival. So it'll give you positive emotions. So the amygdala will turn on either negative emotions when it senses a threat, or positive emotions when it senses something that will enhance your survival. So interestingly enough, when you hear music that you like, the amygdala is tickled. It clicks forward and it turns and it's activated. Now, I recall a interesting experiment done with Oliver Sacks, who is a noted neuroscientist.
Okay, what was that?
Yeah, well, they put him in an fMRI, in a brain scanning machine, and they played two pieces of classical music for him. One was by Beethoven, and one was by Bach. Now, he had a real preference for Bach because he was a musician, and he didn't like Beethoven so much for whatever reason. They found, looking at his brain, that when he listened to Bach, his frontal lobes and his amygdala lit up, and he felt real positive emotion and thrill listening to Bach. But Beethoven, whom he didn't really care for so much, didn't light up his frontal lobes and his amygdala. And the really interesting part about this experiment was they played two pieces, one by Bach, one by Beethoven, that were very similar in musical structure. Couldn't even tell the difference. He couldn't tell which one was Bach and which one was Beethoven, but his brain could. And so when they played the Bach piece that he couldn't identify as Bach, his brain recognized it, and his amygdala clicked into this pleasure response, and it lit up, as did his frontal lobes. When they played the Beethoven, which sounded very similar to Bach, nothing. It was like flat line. So the amygdala is involved in a couple of different aspects, but by giving you pleasure, it is signaling to you that music is good for you and that it enhances your survival. So it's a very interesting observation about how the amygdala is involved in musical perception.
All right, hang with us, Neil. We're going to talk a little bit more about this and then some other aspects of the brain. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got a split show for you tonight. We're talking with Neil Slade. The Brain Tuning is his latest work, and we'll take your calls with him next hour. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Neil Slade with us. We're talking about his latest work, The Brain Tuning. Neil, I've always been fascinated with music and marketing, whether it's in a store or a restaurant or on radio or television. Who handles that? What is a psychologist? What expert sits back and says, look, we want people to eat more, so we're going to play this kind of music? Or we want people to scurry around the store quicker and buy stuff, so we're going to play this kind of music. Who picks that out?
The marketing guys who have done their musical study, for sure. Well, what that indicates, and it kind of ties in with the research study that I did this past December and January, is that certain music causes certain changes in the brain to occur. In other words, certain kinds of musical elements will cause people to be happier and freer with their spending, as opposed to other kinds of music which will make people more cautious and conservative. Other kinds of music will make people scared. This was illustrated by a researcher who went to West Africa many years ago. I attributed this to Borneo, but actually the study occurred in Cameroon. And what he did is he took some piano music to a tribe of natives in this part of Africa who had never heard Western music before. They'd never heard a piano. They'd never heard a C major chord in their life. And so he played, he tried to simplify the experiment very, very, very much. He had three pictures of a woman. One was the woman was smiling and was very happy. And another one, the woman had a frown and was very sad. And then the third picture, she was very scared. And so he played some piano music that was fast and that was in a major key, in a major tonic, something like you might hear in Beethoven's Ode to Joy, da 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 da, mm-hmm. Something major. Happy birthday is in a major key, okay? And the natives who had never heard a chord before in their life invariably pointed to the happy face. And then he played a piece of music that was slow and in a minor key, okay? I'm trying to think of a song that would be, Mozart's 40th symphony starts out in a minor key. But in a slow tempo, in a minor key, they had never heard a... They wouldn't know the difference between major or minor except from hearing it. Invariably, they pointed to the sad face. And then it would be a slow minor. Then when he played something that was very percussive in a minor key but fast, something like you might hear watching a woman being tied to a railroad track in an old silent movie, they would invariably point to the scary face. So our brains are programmed not only culturally, but we're born with circuits in our brain that respond emotionally to certain kinds of musical elements. So to answer your question, these marketers know what kind of music makes people happy and want to spend, and what kind of music will make people frightened and hold on to their wallets very tightly.
That's interesting. It's fascinating. It's a science, isn't it?
It is a science. And you know, I've had some really interesting personal experiences, and everybody's experienced this. You listen to a piece of music, and you feel a thrill. You get goosebumps. You get a chill up your back.
Yeah.
So music is a very, very deeply embedded very complex circuitry process in our brain that makes all kinds of things happen. And last December, I decided, you know, I had a very interesting experience, and it led to the research study that I recently did. And normally, I take a hot bath every night to relax before I go to bed. And One night I decided, well, and I have a little portable DVD player, and I'll put that on the toilet seat and I'll watch a movie in the bathtub.
Just make sure it's not plugged into anything electrical,
It's a battery-powered one.
All right, good, right.
So one night I decided, you know what, I don't feel like a movie. I'm just going to listen to some music. So I put my headphones on, and I had some music that I had composed myself, because I've composed quite a bit of music over the years and recorded quite a bit of music. And I put it on, I turned out the light, and I closed my eyes, and I just you know, listened to the music. And suddenly, just out of nowhere, I had a vision. It was like instantly going into a dream. And it wasn't something that I chose to do. It was something that the music kind of elicited. And I was in a different place. I was in a dreamland. I was in a different landscape. And when I realized that I had kind of quickly traveled to some place in my imagination or my abstract brain, I said, oh, that was really interesting, because I didn't mean for it to happen. So this happened several times in a row, and I would see faces, and I tried it in a number of successive nights. I would see images and faces, and I would get these insights. And I then began to experiment, and I would ask myself a question that I was really perplexed about. And I would just listen to the music without really dwelling. I would just ask the question, then forget it, and the answer would come to me. And I thought, this is really interesting. It's like I'm turning on this altered state of consciousness. So I began to wonder if that happened to me, if music, just listening to music in a dark, undisturbed environment would elicit these altered states of consciousness that I was experiencing, what would happen to other people? So I put together a research study. And a lot of these people came directly. These are coast-to-coast listeners. These are people who heard me on your show and then joined my newsletter. Well, and I knew these people were interested in altered consciousness and paranormal phenomenon and ESP and that kind of thing. So I set up an experiment, and it was to last for 5 weeks. And I said to these people, I want you to listen to this piece of music with headphones in the dark, undisturbed, in a hot bath, or you can listen to it in bed before you go to sleep at night, or, you know, you could even go for a walk at night and put the headphones on and just enjoy the music. And I want you to note what happened, and then send me the results. If you have a daydream, if you have some sort of emotional response to the music, I wanted to know what just listening to music undisturbed, without any distractions, if people would experience that same sort of altered states of consciousness that I was experiencing. And we did this for a month with 65 people, and I was blown away with what people were reporting. You know, these days, music tends to be wallpaper for whatever else we happen to be doing. I mean, when people listen to music, they're either driving their car, or they're exercising, or they've got it in the background while they're studying for it, right? You know, I mean,
that's right.
Music, we sort of lost, I think, around when disco came around. We stopped just sitting around and listening to music. I actually looked at the United States Census, and I was shocked to find out how little, this was like the 2009 census, how little time people actually spent just listening to music. People don't do it much anymore, if at all. And so the experiment was to say to people, I just want you to listen to this specific kind of music and see what happens. And the music I chose, there were certain criteria, because knowing what I know about altered states of consciousness and how the brain works, I really firmly believe that there are certain things that elicit or contribute to being more apt to be open to paranormal perception and extrasensory perception. So there were certain elements in the music that I thought would contribute to this, and I gave I had people listen to this music. It was a very highly educated group of people. Like 50% of the people were postgraduate.
Wow. Okay.
70% of the people were college graduate. So very highly educated. These weren't just a bunch of gullible dopes, as it were. And I said, listen to the music and see what happens. And as it turns out, 78% of the people that listened to the music, and it would take like 10 minutes in the tub listening to it, 78% of the people experienced moderate to high levels of unusual non-sensory perception and paranormal perception. And it ran the gamut from the perception of communicating with dead relatives to precognition of events that happened the following day, insights, finding lost objects, very heightened positive emotional states. And it was just astonishing to see the power of music and what it could elicit in people. And it just turned out to be a very interesting experiment. And before I did it, I wanted to see if anyone had actually made a connection between listening to music undisturbed and paranormal perception.
And I'm sure it did, remarkably so.
Well, it did, but what I was surprised is no one had done this type of experiment before. No one had tried to use music to elicit paranormal sensitivity. This was the first experiment of its kind.
But ancient shamans, Neil, would chant and you know, hum and, you know, and stuff like that. Wouldn't that put them in that same state of mind?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and there's no denying it. But see, in modern society, we've really broken quite a distance from ancient practices. Nowadays, there's so much emphasis on gadgets and technology and what this little device in our hand will do and what's the newest, gizmo to come along. We lost that connection with the power of music. That began to vaporize with the great increase of technology. We've forgotten the power of music. The ancients knew this. If you look at religious ceremony and religious practice and spiritual practice, there is the role of music is incalculable. Go to any church service, part of that service is the playing and singing of music.
Yeah.
Think about drum circles. Historically, music plays an enormous role in altering consciousness. But
in earlier days, for example, when the Brits would go into war, didn't they have like drums beating and everything else?
Oh, absolutely. Well, see, now that's the key. And this is something that I investigated with the study. See, not all music affects different music affects the brain in different ways. So, for example, as you just pointed out, if you want to heighten your fight or flight abilities, mm-hmm. if you're going into battle, you're going to play a very different kind of music than you're going to play if you're trying to lull yourself into sleep. And music that may energize you, like rock and roll. You know, you'll go to a rock and roll concert because you want to be excited and energized. That's the use of that music is going to be very different from the type of music that you're going to listen to elicit paranormal perception and ESP. And so it's kind of, you know, people used to say, oh, well, rock and roll, you know, some people would say rock and roll is unhealthy for you. And this kind of music is good for you. But this, you know, classical music is good for you, but punk rock music is not. I don't believe any of that. I believe that all music has its role, depending on what you want it to do.
Well, that's the key, what you want it to do. Why, though, Neil, are some people, different generations, for example, the music changes for them? Case in point, my granddaughter surely would not listen to something from the 1940s. And older adults might have a difficult time listening to her kind of music, the music she likes. Why is that age perception? Why is that tied in together with age?
There's a couple reasons for that. One is, you know, if you're a baby bird, you have to reject the nest. At some point, you've got to rebel against your parents, or you'll never grow up. You've got to do something different. You've got to explore. It's tied in, you've got to, TD Lingo, my brain mentor and teacher, used to have a saying. It was an anagram for God. He used to say, God is grow or die. So the ability to move forward means, to some degree, to go someplace different from your forefathers. It has to do with novelty. Also, novelty is a very, very important function in the human brain. We strive to seek for novelty. And the reason for that is, novelty means to go someplace you've never been before. And when you do that, you expand the data bank from which you draw upon for survival. If you just do the same old thing over and over and over again, you don't grow. You don't explore. You live within the same four walls all the time. By looking for novel content, we grow. We become more than what we were. Now, in music, this is very interesting, because when you hear a new piece of music that you've never heard before, your brain responds very differently from listening to something that you've heard 1,000 times, right?
That's right.
Haven't we all done this? You find a piece of new music, and the first couple times you hear it, it's like, oh, this is great. This is really exciting. Well, that's your frontal lobes connected to your amygdala rewarding you with pleasure, because you're expanding your mind. Your perception is growing through the perception of novel content in the music. It's good for you. It enhances your survival, okay? But take that same piece of music that was so thrilling the first 10 times you heard it and play it 50 times. Well, by the 50th time, it doesn't thrill you the same way.
You get a little tired of it.
By the 100th time, you're so sick of it, you want to take a hammer to your record, to your CD player or your MP3 player. Novel content is very important. And one thing that was one of the criteria for the music that I used in the music for ESP study.
Which, by the way, you supplied us a little clip. It's on the coasttocoastam.com website that you were so gracious to send us.
Oh, the video clip.
The video clip.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that experiment. What I predicted was that if you listen to music that you're familiar with, it's not going to elicit the same type of extrasensory and paranormal perception as a piece of music that's new to you. And the reason is that I firmly believe that paranormal and extrasensory perceptions are greatly tied in with the frontal lobe.
And speaking of music, Neil, we're going to take this break and come back with more on Coast to Coast AM.